Hello, everyone. I'll call the meeting to order, and we will immediately get into the presentation by the Mayo Clinic. Welcome, folks, to the committee, and why don't you just identify yourself for the tape, and we'll get going. And represent Welty, and represent Norton showed up on time today.
Well, thank you. I'm Keith Linder. I'm the dean at the medical school.
I'm Steve Adams, and I'm chair of the Department of Family Medicine, and I'm here representing the Family Medicine Residency from Mayo.
Go ahead. However you guys want to handle it.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for the chance to come and talk to you about education at Mayo Clinic. I'm going to give a perspective from the medical school, and Steve will talk about the family medicine residency program, and then discuss the budgetary items. Education is really one of Mayo's core principles. We state in our mission that we see our role as to educate physicians, scientists, and allied health professionals. And we also, within education, seek to be a dependable source of information for patients and the public. Education at Mayo is large. There's a full-time faculty within the College of Medicine of nearly 2,200 people. And you can see the distribution of ranks on this slide. Big library, a budget of $2.3 million a year. Our budget for education at Mayo is over $165 million per year in total. This is considerably smaller than the research budget, which is now about $400 million per year, most of which comes from the federal government. Just to kind of put into perspective medical school and residency programs, the students that come to us have completed a four-year undergraduate degree, either usually a BA or BS degree. Then they come to medical school for 4 years and then receive an MD degree. Following this, there's usually a residency, which can range from 3 to 6 years, depending upon the specialty chosen. And then for many fields, there's subspecialty training, which may add another 3 to 6 years beyond the completion of the residency program. So the time from when the students enter college till they emerge can sometimes begin to approach 20 years. So a very long process. Mayo has been in the business of education a long time. Started to grant degrees, well, almost 100 years ago, and this was in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. I'm a graduate of Mayo Medical School. My diploma says University of Minnesota. Steve is a graduate, too. He graduated with my sister. I'm guessing that probably says the same, right?
It does not. No.
It does not.
We actually had a choice. It could say either one. And mine says Mayo Clinic.
So I think this was probably right at that transition in 1984. I was a 79 graduate. And so now our graduates have a Mayo Clinic degree. We've been credited as a degree-granting institution. But when we started, that wasn't the case. The Graduate School of Medicine, residencies and fellowships, is maybe one of the oldest in the country. This started around 1915. The medical school was new. Is relatively new. That started in 1972. Around that same time, there was another school started, the Mayo School of Health-Related Sciences. This really is a training for many of our allied health professionals. Yeah. Right now, there's well over 1,000 students within that school. And then the 1984 graduate school, which issues PhD degrees in biomedical sciences, was formed. And then in 1997, 10 years ago, all of our multiple continuing medical education programs were organized into a school of CME, or continuing medical education. So today, we consider ourselves to be a college with 5 schools within it that are shown here. And our focus really will be the Mayo Medical School and the Mayo Graduate School, which deals with residents. Within our medical school, our mission is to train leaders in practice, education, and research. Our school is small, 42 students. We have a lot of applicants. It's the most competitive school in the country. Harder to get into Mayo Medical School than any other school right now. About half the graduates of the school stay in Minnesota. So we bring students in from all around the country, and those that come tend to stay within the state. And also about 40% of our students who graduate end up going into primary care. We think we have maybe one of the most innovative and certainly one of the most patient-focused curricula of any medical school in the country. As I mentioned, we really do attract a national base of students to come from really coast to coast. Many of them like what they see when they get to Minnesota, and fortunately many of them stay. We have, as you might expect from the SEAL activity, really outstanding performance. 100% of our students graduate. They have an average score on their national board exams that would be at the 90th percentile. So really one of the best performing schools in the country. We have a very diverse student body. When we look at the diversity of our students compared to the national averages, we're 2 to 3 times more diverse than most schools. This has been a focus for us. We've really made efforts to try and be in that position. And I think the other thing that we see is that our students, one of our criteria for selecting them is their commitment to serve the underserved. And so we really have a very aggressive group of students who are interested in doing this and push us to develop opportunities for them to continue to explore these desires of theirs. We've been involved with the University of Minnesota in trying to develop a pipeline program for students coming from underserved backgrounds to try and make it easier for them to come into medicine and go to medical school and then presumably go back and serve the underserved populations. We know that they're interested in doing this, and we're investing in that. If we look at our track record as far as what our students do, when we look now, taking our overall graduates, about half have come from Minnesota. When the school started, 90% of the students needed to come from Minnesota. Only 10% could be from out of state. We now have a national student body, but overall still about half are from the state. Of those that are from Minnesota, about half of those stay here. And again, a lot of our students end up going into primary care. 40% of our students overall select primary care as their field. So what I'd like to do now is turn things over to Steve, who will talk about the residency program, particularly family medicine.
Thanks, Keith. I apologize for my voice. The volume's genetic, so if the person controlling the sound needs to turn it down, that's perfectly fine. Talk to you a little bit about the Mayo School of Graduate Medical Education, of which I'm a product of, and I believe Keith is as well. There's 1,400 residents and fellows. The difference between a resident and a fellow would be somebody that's subspecializing. So they graduated internal medicine, and now they're specializing in gastroenterology, such as what Keith does, or cardiology, something like that. There are 230 programs at Mayo. Many are the most competitive for entry in the entire country. It's one of the largest residency programs in the Midwest. There's 1,100 at Mayo. Rochester is one of the few towns where if somebody has something happen in a crowded room and says, is there a doctor in the house? You ask, is there a cardiologist in the house? You get a little bit more specific. 22,000 alumni since 1915. So Mayo has trained a number of physicians across the country since its beginning in education. The program that I'm representing is a family medicine program, which has been in existence since 1976. It's a rural-based program, and there's a service area in around Cass, Minnesota, where the outpatient facility is of about 18,000, and it trains physicians to treat patients in a rural setting, but not necessarily exclusively that. But that's kind of the focus of it, especially in that location. To give you an idea how busy we are, last year we had 135,000 visits for our department. Roughly a fourth of those were out at Casson, so about 35,000 visits to Casson. So it's a busy place. Excellent training for the residents. Some of the things that the residents are involved in the area, there's a free clinic in Dodge Center that's often pregnancy-related. They do rotations to the Prairie Island Clinic where we have six sites that we staff. One is at the Prairie Island Indian Reservation. It's the Dakota Sioux Tribe. They do work site visits with local employers, McNeilis in the past and others in the area. In-home visits for homebound. Contrary to popular belief, family doctors still make house calls, myself included. In fact, I made one yesterday.
So do politicians.
No, there you go. I like that. We support five rural nursing homes from in the area around Cass and also Pine Island, Pine Haven, and also Kenyon, the Sunset Home. I don't really particularly like that name, but we take care of the majority of the patients in that place. Also, we provide team athletic coverage as well. Some other things that the residents are involved in locally that you might be interested in, they write articles for the Dodge County Independent. It's a local newspaper. They're actually really quite good. The MOST program, which is talks to the local schools, and I can't tell you what MOST is as far as what the acronym means. And I learned that yesterday, and I promptly forgot it, so I apologize for that. Also, the NEST program is for prenatal talks, and that's, again, related to that free clinic in Dodge Center for teen pregnancy and related things. Our program has been real successful. We've filled all of our positions the last 25 years. For those that aren't familiar with primary care, many of the primary care programs in both family medicine, general internal medicine, and pediatrics do not fill their programs nationally. That has not been a problem for us. In fact, I would say the quality of our residents has actually been constantly improving. 54% of the program graduates practice in Minnesota. We're actually a net importer of family physicians. In other words, of the group that we select to do residency, less than half come from Minnesota and over half stay in Minnesota. I hope that's good news for you. It is to me. 17 of the 29 grads who practice in Minnesota since 2000 came from outside, so roughly 60%, so what I just mentioned. 9 of the 29 graduates since 2000 practice in rural Minnesota, and we're defining that as communities less than 10,000, in case you want to know what I think of rural. This map gives you an idea where our residents have located. There's two pins that we didn't get on there. We have a physician, Russ Burgum, who's in Eveleth, Minnesota, and Dan Mark, who's in Duluth.
Did you do that just for me?
What's that?
Did you do that just for me, Doc?
No, that was. When I look at this map yesterday, I said, well, you left Dan and Russ off. So, anyway, that's where Russ went. They both have extra certification in sports medicine, too. Why they wound up there, I'm not really sure. Russ is actually from there. He's from, I believe he grew up in Chisholm, I'm pretty sure. And now he's up in Eveleth, and then Dan is in Duluth, but actually spends part of his time in Eveleth, if I'm not mistaken. These are the budgetary items. These figures are all in thousands. So for the biennium of 2008 and 2009, we're endorsing the governor's recommendation of $2.452 million. The initial increase from 2007 to 2008 is actually a restoration of money that was actually cut from our budgets. And I can't tell you the year that happened, but there was a substantial cut. So we're happy to see that he's recommended a restoration of that and an increase for 2009 as well. In conclusion, medical education is a core mission of Mayo. The figures on what we spend on education and research look really huge, and it's like, well, you know, it's like, boy, you've got these big budgets. We count on extra funding to make those budgets work. Mayo puts a lot of money into the education and research, but can't meet all the obligations. Otherwise, we have to cut programs. I know I feel very proud about what the family medicine residency has done, and I think the state should take a fair amount of pride in that as well. Certainly responsible for the initiation of the medical school, and have been very good supporters of our family medicine residency as well. So I think it's a good return on your investment. I will tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a product of Minnesota education, I guess, from start to finish. I grew up in Mankato. I went to Mankato State, now Minnesota State, and then Mayo Medical School, Mayo Graduate School of Medical Education, did residency, and now I'm still at Rochester practicing. So, and I think Keith's got a similar story as well. That's all I have.
Well, thank you very much for all of the information, Dr. Linder and Dr. Adamson. You know, when you said, is there a cardiologist in the house, you have to make the assumption that they have a heart first. And, you know,
there you go.
Some of us, they claim, don't. But I've got proof. I took my when you went in that little machine that turns you, but it's not the CAT scan. It's another little one, kind of rotates around you. So I've got proof, and I brought those things down so I could prove that I've got a heart, because I was going to ask Governor Pawlenty if he's got proof. But anyway, questions for the... I know you do represent Gunter. You don't have to jump in here. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Representative Gunter, for the witnesses or on my comments?
I just, on your comments, I would like
to... I'm not recognizing you. For the witnesses. I do have some questions. You know, you are probably the most prestigious medical facility in the country, and certainly known throughout the world, and your school is absolutely wonderful. And I'm wondering if you do, or if you could consider, if you don't, a wider expanse of your residency program, get more people exposed to all of rural Minnesota, in a lot of fine communities that have nice regional medical centers or county medical centers, and if you do that now or if you might consider that. Either one of you could respond.
If I may, Chairman, may I answer? Thank you. I'll respond to that. We've had several attempts at a rural training track that would involve exactly what you're talking about. Unfortunately, what happened about the time that the track was completed and we were ready to go forward to try to get funding and that kind of thing for it, it's about the same time that the number of applications to family medicine residencies took a big nosedive, and several residencies folded about the same time. And so it actually got stalled. You know, we did get involved with the St. Cloud family medicine residency, and our commitment to them was to get them off the ground until they got full certification, which they did. A better affiliation for them, of course, is for the U of M. It's just a geographically much more integrated type thing than all the way down to Rochester. But it's a very good question, and sadly, the national market, I guess, if you will, doesn't lend itself for doing that right now. But we've made several attempts in the past, and probably will again if things change, if the landscape changes.
Well, I would hope that you might, because... You know, do you, on your other programs, do you encourage them, the doctors, to locate in rural Minnesota, and are there financial incentives for their schooling to do that, either Dr. Linder or Addison?
Thank you. I'll take a crack at that. One of the things that characterizes our school is a relatively low out-of-pocket expenses. Our tuition is amongst the lowest in the nation for private schools. And then with benefactors and also these state monies, we're able to keep the students' out-of-pocket expenses down. And so they're not being driven to make career choices based on a huge financial debt. Some students at other schools are leaving medical school with $250,000 in debt. And oftentimes with that type of debt looming over you at age 26 or 27, when you're going into a residency that pays $35,000 a year, you start to think of what can I do to eventually leverage this debt. So it's been important for us to try and have our students leave with a low debt so that the career choices that they make could include things such as primary care or particularly serving underserved areas, including rural areas. It's our students don't need to feel like they need to be high-priced plastic surgeons. That's one component of what we try to do for the students. Give them the choices that are free them from some of the financial concerns. The other thing that's happened with our curriculum, we've provided a lot of flexibility in years one and two so that the students can do things that start to open their eyes as to what they might do in their career. And so with this regional network, the Mayo Health System, which is largely rural, there are now electives, or what we call selectives, that the students can go out and spend time seeing what it's like to be in a rural setting, get firsthand experience, and start molding them. And we're starting to see our students looking for those kinds of opportunities. And our health system has asked to have the students come out and do that. So we're going to, I think we'll have the students really get some robust chances for exposure to what those kinds of practices would be like. It's been difficult in the past.
Okay, other questions? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And I want to thank both Dr. Linder and Dr. Adamson for coming to testify today on behalf of Mayo Institution. And I know there are others here today in the audience as well on behalf of Mayo. And so I'll have one question, and if the doctors can answer it, it'd be great. If you need to defer to somebody else, just want you to know that that's possible as well. But first of all, I just want to say, just like the Iron Range is a gem in Minnesota, we also have another gem in Minnesota, and that's Mayo. And there are other gems across the state as well. But with Mayo, if you ever come down to Rochester, southeastern Minnesota, and you run into somebody who is a Mayo employee, many times you will find that they are either grew up in Minnesota, or it's very common to find that they are from someplace else throughout the United States, if not throughout the world. And you ask them why they came to Minnesota, and it's because they knew about Mayo, and they wanted to work for Mayo. Mayo has a tremendous reputation throughout the country, if not throughout the world. And I'm always impressed. As area legislators representing Rochester in the Mayo area, we are invited to come in many times to be briefed on the issues. And it's amazing to see what they are doing at that medical institution every day. And the advancements that are being made, the research that takes place there, and how they're contributing to the betterment of society. Our healthcare has had many advances because of the research and the technology and what they're doing at Mayo. So I just want to put in a little plug for you. The other thing is, I just want to draw attention to members, if you want, in your book or in your binder, there's a section on Mayo Clinic. And in there it says that I'm on page 2 of the Mayo budget. And I'd just like to point this out and then ask for a little clarification on it. It says that Mayo Clinic continues to invest in education and research. Total commitment to education was $165 million in 2005, with Mayo funds accounting for $123 million of this amount. And so when you're before us, you're only requesting about $2 million. And so I just wanted to find out the other $123 million, where does that go? And why are you only asking for the $2 million? And I guess my third question would be, is that sufficient?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, thank you.
He's only been around me a couple of months, and he's already acting like an Iron Ranger. So go ahead.
Oh, very good. Actually, I have a cabin just off the Iron Range, so it's kind of dear to my heart, too. Is it too late to change the request? Could we dial it up a little bit? Yeah, there you go. No, that's a good question, and I think it's part of it's probably realism as far as funds that are available from outside sources. You know, certainly Mayo can't ask to have that kind of robust education in Rochester and depend entirely on outside funding. It's just not going to work that way. I think for what we are able to provide ourselves, it does show kind of what our commitment is to it. It does beg the question, though, and I guess I'll answer it before anybody asks. It's like, well, you know, gee, if the appearable supply, you know, that much, you know, what if? Well, the extra that we get to make up the difference is actually critical, particularly for programs like mine, where it's a substantial part of the stipends that the residents get. There's not enough money in primary care and what we do to actually continue with that education without that kind of funding. So I can answer it from kind of that one little sort of microcosm of what, you know, kind of what I can look at. And that answer would probably perpetuate kind of through a number of other programs. Frank's probably got more of an answer. It's probably a little bit more politically correct, but that's what I would say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Yossi. I would like to address the part of Representative Welty's question about the shortfall there, or the money that in the budget that's not provided by Mayo. And I should first off say that most of the $123 million that we finance ourselves is from contributions from grateful patients and organizations. I'm not sure it's going to add up exactly, but the difference is a small part of it is the appropriation we're requesting here today, but the largest part is federal money through the Medicaid program for indirect and direct medical education. However, there's an incredibly important part of that, and I want to take the opportunity to thank the legislature of the state of Minnesota. The MERC program is extraordinarily important to the trainers of physicians and dentists and advanced practice nurses and others in this state. And unfortunately, because of the federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, we are under the gun to change our program, but it has been a great asset to us. Mayo is set to receive about $15 million this year overall for all of our medical education programs, and that may drop by as much as 40% if the federal government continues where it's going, and if the request in the governor's budget for a $16 million for the MERC program is not funded. Apart from all of that, the president has recommended that there be no medical education funds out of Medicaid, which would be a devastating thing to particularly University of Minnesota and Mayo. We're hopeful that doesn't happen, but that is a possibility.
Okay. Any other questions?
Chair Rubina, and I'm just wondering, you have a foundation, I'm assuming. How do they help to support the students?
This is Keith Linder. If we look at the average cost, if we take our budget and divide it by the number of students, the students per student is $67,000 per year per student, probably comparable to the University of Minnesota and many medical schools around the country. The tuition is about $27,000, and so we use some monies, including the monies we're asking for today, as well as the monies that grateful patients have provided to defray some of the tuition costs in scholarships. But that $40,000 difference between the tuition and the cost per student is really covered by the institution. So it's an expensive proposition for an institution to have a medical school. We're putting about $40,000 per year of Mayo monies per student.
Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland, the $123 million I mentioned out of whatever, $165 is money that's been raised through the development process, and that's the foundation part of it. I should also note out that most of the research money comes from the Federal National Institutes of Health, which is highly competitive, but there also is money that comes through grateful patients through the development program.
Gentlemen, since Representative Welty did bring it up, I think somewhat jokingly, but on a more serious note, obviously we all know how important education is to you. The state has always prided itself on education, and recently, because of some tax changes and the economic environment and that, we've been in a world of hurt, which even though there's rumors of alleged surpluses, most of it is one-time money. You're both, very educated people. I'm assuming your income is a little higher than mine. So what do you think we should do to fund what I think is a big shortage, not only in the higher education system, but our K-12 system in general? You don't have to answer that question. Do you have any personal opinions as citizens?
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I guess I would answer it with the story that I told of my neighbor when we had a bond issue before us in Rochester, and he was absolutely dead set against it. And I said, Tom, I said, the worst that will happen is you're going to overfund the education for your kids. I said, how bad can that be? And it's like, I don't know, you put it that way. For me, I guess it's one of the critical things that the state or, whatever government entity you look at provides for its citizens, whether it's K through 12 education or higher education with, a flagship college like University of Minnesota or where I went, now Minnesota State. To me, it's critical to the success and enduring success of the state. So, to me, it's a huge priority. I hope it is for you all, but that's how I would answer the question.
Representative Mark, he probably voted for your bond.
I was going to say, now I... Chair Rukavina, I need to thank you for the support as a former school board member for that vote and for advocating for it in the future. Back to your presentation, you talked about having over 50% or 54%, I think, of your graduates staying in the state. How many of those actually continue working for Mayo Clinic, just out of curiosity?
If I may?
Sure.
Thank you. For the family medicine residency, we'll generally recruit maybe as many as two of the residents per year. Oftentimes it's zero. This last year it was one. We hope to have, for the better residents, we hope to have a position available, but oftentimes it doesn't happen.
And if I could just continue. And I want to thank you for that, because I think sometimes people get the feeling that Mayo Clinic might be self-serving, or the Mayo Medical School might be self-serving to Mayo Clinic, and in fact, not only is it benefiting the entire country, but more so the entire state of Minnesota, and particularly this residency program. So thank you for clarifying that.
Sure.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of had a follow-up to that question. I just wanted to ask where those people would be. They're not all then stationed in Rochester. They would be in other Mayo facilities throughout the state. Is that what you're, is that part of your answer, that if they're a Mayo resident, or if you keep them on, would they stay in Rochester?
Dr.
Anderson? Yeah, if I may, thank you. It would be at one of our six sites. So Mayo Rochester Family Medicine, we have three sites in the city limits, one site at Casson, we have a small site in Kenyon, Minnesota, and then also one at Prairie Island. So it would be, if I'm talking about recruiting internally, it would be for one of those six sites, yep.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Welch, did you have a follow-up?
Just a follow-up kind of along those lines. When you look at the statistics, it's good to note that almost half of the graduates end up staying in Minnesota, but a question to follow up on that, out of the half that leave the state, are they leaving the state because they cannot find positions within the state, or are they leaving the state just for the fact that they want to go find a sunnier state? So I guess I'm just wondering, you know, you're doing a very good job of producing doctors, and is it because we just don't have the openings across the state that many of them leave?
Dr. Lynn, or Anderson?
Yeah, if I may, thank you. For a number of reasons. It's not that there are not positions available. That would not be the reason. We have had the chance over the years of had several residents from Texas. And Texas is like a state of mind. They all go back to Texas. The one exception, our program director is actually from Texas and decided he liked Minnesota. But a number of them will go back home. A number of them will find positions that are just not duplicatable here in Minnesota for whatever reason, whether it's climate or a certain patient mix that they want, or a certain style of practice that they want that we can't duplicate. There's a number of reasons.
Thank you very much, then, members, for your testimony, and we're in the office of... Frank's around here all the time. We got to get moving. My office fire. Okay, Frank, go ahead.
I wanted to respond to your question.
I still remember you wouldn't put a Mayo Clinic up in Virginia, so I was, you know...
It wasn't my decision. I was all for it, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond to your question about investment in higher education, K-12. As you may know, the House Ways and Means Committee will be conducting a hearing in Rochester on February 26th. And what I'm going to say is probably what we will be saying at that time as well. Mayo Clinic is the largest private employer in Minnesota and contributes about $1.3 billion to the state economy and would love to continue doing that. But one of the things that limits us is the ability to hire trained, professional, technical people. And so higher education is extremely important to us. K-12 is as well. And I have to take this point of personal privilege to mention that when the bond issue that Dr. Adamson was referring to, which was a number of years ago, even before Representative Norton was on the school board, let alone the legislature, that she and I were the co-chairs of that bond issue. It was the fourth time it finally passed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. And while the Office of Fire Education is coming up, Representative Gunther. Go ahead, you can take your shot now.
You?
Yeah.
All right,
I knew you had a heart,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank
all
you.
Along.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. And I knew you did, too. So, what's that,
I just said I needed more proof.
I've got the thing. They get pink and blue, and it shows how good your art's working. You know. So, we've got a quorum now. So, Representative Stevenson moves the minutes from yesterday's meeting, which I'm sure he's read. And thank you. Any questions, additions, corrections? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Welcome back to the committee. Folks, I guess unless there are more presentations, did you have a nice dinner last night, Mr. Mishkan? Have a good time at the...
Mr. Chair, I did. Thank you.
And I didn't wish you a happy Valentine's Day.
I'm sorry about that, too.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention, Mr. Chair, that my wife and her friend, if you and Senator Tomasoni had wished to use the dance floor, they were more than willing to be your partners last night.
Well, sure, now you tell us that. Yeah. Okay. welcome back, and members... do you have any more to present, Ms. Eckhardt, or are we in questions, or were you wrapping up your presentation? I didn't know if you wanted to do any.
Mr. Chair and members, we have a few more slides to walk through.
Okay.
It's the balance of the governor's higher education items, and then we've got some language changes, and I don't know, those would be on pages 40 through the balance of the presentation, and I guess I'd like to find out from you, do you want us to walk through those quickly as well?
Certainly, whatever
okay.
you would, your wish.
I think we left off, Mr. Chair members, at slide 38, and that's the reciprocity payment to North Dakota.
Okay.
And Mr. Canis will take that.
Mr. Chair members, let me address this slide and the following slides. There are actually two requests on this slide. The first one is for tuition reciprocity. It's an increase of $1 million a year. There was a period of time when we'd had no payment to North Dakota. This has changed in the last year. In fact, it exceeded the appropriation available, so at least for the year. So we're requesting an additional $1 million a year to cover the payment that we anticipate having with North Dakota the next couple of years.
We've got your
okay.
presentation here on paper, so if you want me, we could have one of the kids in the audience come down and help with this.
Somebody younger than us want to try to fix it.
Go ahead, just keep going with this. Because
the reason for this is that just the flow of students has changed between the two states, so it's a part of the ongoing agreement with that state. The second part on the slide at the bottom simply shows the compensation adjustment. I talked about the 2% yesterday. $39,000 for the first year and $80,000 for the second year. And we were trying to think when the last time the legislature had appropriated a salary supplement, and it has been a long time, six to 8 years, we're not quite sure. But state agencies have had to make things fit for quite a while.
Mr. Chair, if I just might add, when we have to increase salaries, give a bump to our employees, 2-3%, and 3% has really been the max. We have to find that out of our existing resources, and we've had to do that for a number of biennials.
Well aware of that. I think, as a matter of fact, Mr. Mishkanis, it might be all the way back to Rudy, although I think perhaps Governor Carlson did one salary supplement for everyone, too. But while we're here, then, let me ask this question, which was similar to one I asked yesterday. Even in your office, where will you find the... are you assuming that negotiations will stay at 2% for your staff, or if there's higher increases in the bargaining with APSME and MAPE and others, will then that be found? That's got to be found within your current budget, so what's going to get cut if that happens?
So, Mr. Chair and members, what we've done in the past, I can really just speak to that. What we've done in the past is we have a couple positions that we didn't fill. And so then we had some existing resources. One of our auditors passed away. another auditor position we did not fill. We have a couple other auditors still on staff. And we've basically found the money within existing resources. And we try to stay on the conservative side on the adjustments for that very reason. But in the past, we've had to really make do with what we have, and we've looked at positions. We've not filled positions, but we've looked at open positions.
Ms. Seagard, how many FTEs over there that you're funded for do you not have filled?
Well, right now, I have to ask, wait one second, Mr. Chair. It's just two auditor positions, correct? There's two auditor positions that I'm aware of, and one we're in the process of interviewing for an auditor right now. So there's one auditor position that's open.
Otherwise, all of your funding for all of your positions are filled.
That's correct. And, Mr. Chair, we, as I said, our budget, we are about half state funded in terms of employees, and the rest is a balance of federal funds and then our loan program. There are people that work on the loan program, and they're funded out of the loan program.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, one other point on that is 2 years ago, we realized that we had a whole boatload of unutilized space, so we consolidated some of the offices, we reduced our lease space needs, got some savings from that, and shifted some costs to the federal program to cover it as well. So we're trying to be both smart and creative. The next slide then, Mr. Chair, this would be slide 39, is the request for the increase for the learning network. Ms. Seagard described what that is yesterday and some of the pressures because of increased online learning, video use, etc. This is $575,000 each year off of about $1.15 million off a biennial base of about $8.45 million. That, Mr. Chair, is the end of the funding request. The next four or five pages have to do with language.
Do you want to go over that, Ms. Seagard?
If you're willing, Mr. Chair, I think if we can try to go through it fairly quickly, I'll ask Ms. Grimes to help me and Mr. Mishkanis, because we'll sort of there are pieces in here that she knows more about than I do and vice versa. So we'd like to just quickly walk through some of these changes. I think some of them will interest your members. Do you want to do the first one?
Mr. Chair, at the end of the appropriations section there, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm Tricia Grimes. I work for the Office of Higher Education. At the end of our appropriations section, there is a section on reporting, and we're asking for a new permission to do a new study on participation in post-secondary education by income and also persistence and graduation rates. This would match up data from our student enrollment record database with our financial aid database, and that does need some legislative permission in order for us to do that.
Ms. Grimes, is there a internal appropriations change here for that, or how are you going to fund that?
Mr. Chair, no, the plan is to fund it out of existing resources. It's really the permission to match data from the two databases that's why we're asking for language. But we're going to use it with existing research staff.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I'm wondering, it's always been kind of my question on how many of the students are actually signing up and how many are falling out on the first, second year. Are those some numbers in terms of whether they're failing academically or they're just dropping out because college doesn't seem to be their bag? Is that to the point of some of this study?
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, that is one of the things we would like to track. Right now, MNSCU is able to track some of that data, and the University of Minnesota is able to track some of that data, but we'd like to be able to do it for higher education in the state as a whole, including students attending private institutions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, I'm still not clear. You know, every time we ask an agency in a state to do something, they say it costs money, but when you guys do it, it doesn't cost any money. How does that happen?
Mr. Chair, this is actually a study that the agency has been wanting to do for a long time, and we consider it a very high priority. And so our existing research staff, the only thing that's been stopping us from doing it in the past is having the permission to match the data from the databases.
That kind of answered all my questions. So if I told you or Representative Bly passed a bill to tell you to do a study, we'd get a fiscal note on it. Mr. Mishkanis, you were good with, you know, fiscal.
Mr. Chair, 2 years ago, I think we had 12 studies either requested by the legislature or directed by the governor, and we got funding for one of them related to the accountability work. But we performed all the other studies with no additional money, nor did we ever do a fiscal note on him that I recall.
That you recall. Okay.
You see? No, I have one question.
No, we have nothing over here.
I think Representative Gunther knows what I'm talking about.
This might be contagious. This would be good.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, then let me move to the bottom part of that slide on the funding policy statutes. I alluded to this a bit yesterday when talking about the general work on education funding. 2 years ago, again, the current law was changed at the time that called for an enrollment adjustment in the base projections for the higher education systems. That was there's kind of two parts to that. The governor had asked for a report or a study of that enrollment adjustment. The House and in the end, the conference report actually included a repeal of the enrollment adjustment, but the study remained. So we put together a group of stakeholders, both from the University of Minnesota and from the NSCU, some business people. Jim Nobles was on there, and Pam Wheelock served on this group. So it was a good group that studied this. Out of that came a report that looked at the 67% issue about instructional costs, other issues relating to simply repealing language that was no longer necessary because the enrollment adjustment was gone. A series of meetings were held, public meetings, of course. There was a student on the group as well, I should mention. The report was issued last year, and from that came some recommendations for language changes. They were part of a bill last year, but given the nature of things, nothing passed, so the governor's bringing it back again this year. I know that the 67% is a changed in tenor, I guess, if I could best describe that, from what it was 2 years ago. One thing that came out of this report about the 67% in the funding policy legislature was a recommendation to repeal that, but not to not give it further thought. I should say that particular provision law seems less important to the University of Minnesota. They have concerns about research money than to the Minsky system, so they were less concerned about it in these meetings than Minsky was. So I think it's an area that, regardless of what you do with the language, I think it actually does deserve some good discussion and debate.
Members, any comments on that proposed law change? I guess, Representative, before I call on Representative Hartman, I'll just give you mine. I think, you know, let me ask then, is there the governor's philosophy that we shouldn't strive towards a two-thirds, one-third public institution funding formula in the state anymore? Ms. Hegard, you want the political?
Mr. Chair, I've not heard the governor say those words exactly, but I think he expressed support for the concept that we didn't need to have something in statute stating what the commitment should be. But I've never heard him say to me or to others that there ought not to be a strong commitment from the state.
So this is the governor's bill that we're talking about here and that I have here in front of us. So the governor doesn't support this, but it's in his bill.
Mr. Chair, I didn't say that. I've never heard him say that he thinks that there ought to be a commitment there. He asked that a study be put together. These folks came up with a recommendation, and I think he felt that it was a good recommendation in general and decided to have that be part of this bill. I don't know. Do you have anything else to add?
Mr. Chair, members, not on where the governor stands, but to the extent that you would decide to retain this in current law, I think they actually need to get some good data from the systems about once you've reached it, how do you know? Mr. Burton will tell you the machinations he goes through and trying to try to decompose, if you will, the appropriations between instructional and non-instructional costs. Yeah. It always says 67% in the bill, but it really hasn't been 67% for quite a while.
Mr. Michigan, I would say those statistics I've seen from different national organizations that rate different states and their higher ed spending and, you know, show us at least being near that for until recently, then somebody's giving somebody the wrong information they're always showing Minnesota until about 2000, I believe, maybe 99, whatever, close to that goal. But I think this might be a tough one to sell
at least to my side of the aisle, and probably the same over in the Senate. But with that, Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was just, what was the rationale for taking that out? And you really, I mean, essentially asked the same question, but maybe if you could just share with me what did the working group come up with that made them think we should take this out of statute? To me, it seems like you're saying that the imprecision of looking at the costs, I just think it's really ironic. We're talking about adding a 70% rule in K-12, but we're saying that the numbers are so imprecise in higher ed, we can't tell what's instructional and what's not, so we don't want to put a percentage in statute. I was just curious where it comes from to take it out. It just seems really strange to me.
Go ahead.
Sure. And again, I'll just read from the report that was released last January. And this is information from the systems. For Minsky, the percentage in 1998 was 63.8, and by 2003 it dropped to 54. And I think Dave actually testified that it's around 50% now. For the University of Minnesota, 1998 was 46%, and as of 2003, it was 37.7. So part of the discussion is it's not a question of being imprecise because we have some data. My sense is always a question of reality. It would take a lot of money to get 37.7% up to 67%. Or you could simply redefine the way you do the appropriation and tell the university to spend that much money out of the appropriation that is needed to get to 67%. I'm not sure how they would react to that. You'd have to have that conversation.
I'm not sure how they would either. I probably am sure how they would react. But I'm curious, in this working group, were faculty and students...
Mr. There was a student on there. We're required by law to have students on all our task forces.
Okay, sorry, Representative Harmon, did you have a follow-up?
Well, just a follow-up point that, I mean, I think the aspirational goal of having that in the statute, it serves a different purpose than whether or not we're meeting it. And I think if we don't have a benchmark, then we're not aiming toward anything. And if there's a reason to not have the benchmark be 67%, I'm interested in knowing what the reason is. But if the reason is just we're not meeting it, so let's lower or eliminate that expectation, then I don't understand it.
I don't know if you want to comment on that. Go ahead, then. Ms. Grimes, or whoever.
Mr. Chair, the language in Section 10 and 15 is about requiring that institutions that are eligible to have their students receive Minnesota state grants and cell phones would be required to be participating in the federal Pell Grant program starting 4 years from now at the beginning of federal fiscal year 2012. Right now there are about 16 institutions, and usually each year there are four or five new ones that are participating in the state grant program and the cell phone program but are not participating in the federal Pell Grant program. And many of these are cosmetology schools, but they are career schools. And I think the students who attend those institutions don't realize that if they went to a different cosmetology school, sometimes just down the street, that they could be getting a Pell Grant in addition to their state grant. So this would become a requirement. This will, in fact, increase costs some for these small schools and for new schools to get started, because under the federal rules, they would have to operate for 2 years before they could get federal student aid, and they do have to be accredited. And both of those things are cause some expense for the institution. But one practical example, Mr. Chair, is last year we had a very small cosmetology school that got up and running and started school in the fall, and they called up and actually told us that they were really glad that the self-loan program existed because it was paying all the bills around there. And that, in fact, it was students who owed the money on the self-loans, and that is, the self-loans were not meant to be a small business loan to get a business up and running. And unfortunately, that particular school went out of business a little bit later. Now, there were only four or five students who got aid to go to that school. It wasn't a huge amount of state money involved, and it was something that we have been working with the police in the community where that institution was to try to recover some of those funds. But that's the kind of example that we're trying to prevent by requiring that the institutions participate in the federal programs rather than having a separate set of state requirements. We thought we would just use the federal requirements so that everybody could be on the same page about what the state and federal requirements are.
And is the time lag there, Ms. Grimes, so that they can adjust to this, the ones that are legitimate?
Mr. Chair, yes. It takes a couple of years, probably three, to go through the accreditation process, and that's one of the reasons for this timeline, is to give the institutions a chance to gear up and to also spread the cost over several years. The next item is in Article 2, Section 12. This has to do with the treatment of incarcerated students when it comes to eligibility for state grants. When a student is incarcerated, we subtract the Pell Grant that they are no longer eligible for. Our law says that we're supposed to subtract the Pell Grant. After that law was adopted, the state adopted some language that said that students who are incarcerated are not entitled to a living miscellaneous expense allowance because their living expenses are being covered by the state already. So that already is in law. After we adopted this procedure, the federal government since came along and made it so that incarcerated students are not allowed to get Pell Grants, but we still subtract the Pell Grant as if they were. Quite frankly, we do not have clear legal authority under state statute to do what we are currently doing. And this language would give us that authority. The net effect of doing this, I have to say, is that very few incarcerated students end up eligible for a state grant.
Mr. Chair, I'll take the next one on this. I'll take the next small piece at the end on the self-loan. What we're seeking here is authorization to enter into a financial arrangement called interest rate swaps. These are investment techniques. They're fairly sophisticated, but we've been dealing with our investment bankers and our financial advisors. They've demonstrated, at least to our satisfaction, that this would be a good way to reduce our risk and our investments. And we do have substantial investments in the cell phone program. Just on a current basis, like the report I saw the other day, we're at about $147 million that we're investing in the market before we actually use the money for loans to students. This program is substantial. It's of almost $900 million in total assets. So we're seeking authorization. We're not quite sure how we would like to use it. We would take baby steps, I would assure you, because it is something new. Housing Finance Agency currently has this authority, and I believe PCA does as well. So this would just give us the authority to do similar investment.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. We kind of jumped by that other one, the previous one on treatment of incarcerated students. Was this precipitated by some of the rioting that had taken place on the campus, or is this something, some older language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, this practice has been in place for quite some time, and no recent news events did not have any effect on it. Quite frankly, a legislative staffer pointed out to us that we did not have the full legal authority to do what we're currently doing, and we're trying to rectify that situation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And so what we're doing is we're basically saying if the individual has been incarcerated, then they are no longer eligible for a Pell Grant, gives you the authority to retract those funds. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, what this language would do is give us the authority to continue to do what we've been doing, which is to subtract the Pell Grants for that student even if they are not actually legally entitled to get one. The net effect of it is that very few incarcerated students get state grants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So the next slide on 42, I'll walk through these, Mr. Chair and members. The first bullet, intervention for college attendance programs, I think I talked with you a little bit about that yesterday. Mm-hmm. There's an appropriation, I think it's about $500,000 a year, $400,000 a year. It's available on a competitive basis to higher ed and community groups who want to focus on improving young people's chances of getting to college. What we like to do is just add the word retention to the program, because we also think that there need to be exemplary programs that are really successful in retaining those same students in college. We'd like to try to promote those and highlight those as well. The challenge doesn't end once the student gets to college. If you look at some of our graduation rates across all the sectors, you'll find some challenges there. And so this program we'd like to open up to include retention programs as well as college encouragement program. And there's no additional money included in the budget for it at this time. The college savings plan, we would be making a change, again, without asking for any additional revenue. Right now, the matching grant for families under $80,000 is $300. We'd like to increase that match to $400. And we'd like to increase percentage of contributions match from 5 to 10% for families in the $50,000 to $80,000 income group. We think that that'll help those families more. And we can do that without increasing appropriation. We've got unused funds right now in that program, and we'd like to do a better job there. Prevention of fraudulent degrees. I know that this is something, Mr. Chair, that you're not exactly warm to, but we have included
this. I don't know where you would have heard that, Mr. Yard, other than the fact that the libertarian in me doesn't really want anybody, any more people in the system. So, in other words, if I say I got a master's degree in philosophy and I really only have a BA, I'm going to get charged with a misdemeanor now?
Well, Mr. Chair, possibly. The point of this...
I don't know if Representative Atkins really has a law degree, but he's been practicing for a lot of years. So. Go ahead.
This came, Mr. Chair, this came to us from several folks. We didn't think of this really ourselves. I mean, it came to us from people who've been concerned about three mill schools, funding schools that are not legitimate, that might be operating in the state. The problem is, even at the federal level, they try to go after some of those institutions, and it's next to impossible to do that. So the thought is that if we can't go after them, we might as well go after the student who knowingly is using a degree for a false reach. And that's the reason for our putting this in the bill.
Members, any comments on that? Representative Gunther? Do you have a doctor of grocery?
Just a master's.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Candace will take the last couple of slides on our proposals to review the regulation statutes for institutions at our agency.
Mr. Chair, members, these two are related. The first slide on page 43 kind of gives you a picture of how things are today. And this is a simple table. We showed you this in a form of a Venn diagram that you recall from your youth. These things would be laying all over each other. We generally regulate institutions in two ways under two different statutes. One is the registration, which is Chapter 136A, and the other is under licensure statutes in 141. The difference is this, essentially the registered schools have a little lighter touch. We look at the licensed schools a bit more thoroughly with their programs in more detail. What the table on page 43 shows you is that it kind of breaks things down by degree-granting schools, non-degree-granting schools in the middle section, and then out-of-state public and private schools. But there are groups of schools, for instance, the first line, that's the non-for-profit degree-granting. There's 49 that are registered and none that are licensed, but the next line, you have some in both categories. So what we're trying to do, there's been a lot of concern about this the last 2 years. We're trying to go to some kind of a criteria that says, look, if you're a degree-granting school, you're going to be treated one way. And if you're a non-degree granting school, you'll be treated as a licensed school. And that would be the effect that is shown on page 44. So what occurs is schools will be shifted between the two statutes and levels of regulation based on whether they offer degrees, and that would be at the associate level or above. If there's some issue with fees as well, that would be shifted and stay with them. We don't want to change the fees for schools that would move from registered to licensed. But again, we're trying to clean things up and straighten them up, but I would admit that I don't believe all the private schools are supportive of this recommendation, even though we've been talking about this for 2 years now.
And that's it.
That's all.
Okay, members.
Thank you.
Any questions on any of the, or comments on any of the proposals here? Or for the agency itself, from members. Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, thank you for your presentation. You handled some difficult questions over the last couple of hearings pretty well. I have a slightly off topic. The Indian Scholarship Office currently is housed in the Minnesota Department of Education, or Education Department, whatever it's called now. And access is very difficult for northern Minnesota Native Americans, where most of them reside, in fact. Would your office be accepting of a relocation of that scholarship office to your office, which might be a more appropriate location, perhaps relocating that back to its rightful location in the Bemidji area, smack dab in the middle of the three reservations, largest reservations? Want to comment on that? Or
do you want to take that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, this is an issue that's come before us in the past several times. And I think it's complicated. So it's something that we'd certainly be willing to talk about, but I think it's very important that all the relevant stakeholders be present. There are people with strong feelings on both sides of that issue, whether it ought to be centrally located down here at the Department of Education in Roseville, or it ought to be located outstate. That's one question. And if it's in greater Minnesota, where in greater Minnesota should it be?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Minnesota Chippewa Tribe unanimously passed a resolution last week, which is over 90% of the tribal members in the state of Minnesota supporting relocating it to Bemidji and housing it in your office. So, or housing it in higher education. So, I think perhaps the most relevant stakeholders, the recipients of those scholarships, you know, have spoken. And so what other stakeholders might you be talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, you know, I'm not certain at this end, but I do know that when the issues come before the body, before us, it's been complicated. And there have been lots of concerns expressed, not by us, but by others, by stakeholders. So I just would urge caution, since it's something that we've dealt with, I'd say, at least three or so times before, you know, in the past several years, we've addressed the issue. And I just think it'd be wise to talk about it during the session. I think that would be a good idea.
You know, when I'm looking at your core functions that you cite in Minnesota statutes, I don't know if the bullets are in order of your priorities or not, but just for the record, you know, your main charge, I think, is, and maybe that's reflected in there, is to administer state financial aid programs and really not to be out there, you know, monitoring a new achieve to or this performance pay that you talked about. At least I feel that. But I see your second bullet is to publish and distribute to the students and parents information about academic and financial preparations, including financial aid. You know, you are the major lender in the state and major grant, you know, office. And maybe you should do a little more concentrating in that area, because we had students from all over the state come in here and talk about their debt, and a lot of them didn't know how bad they were getting in debt, and a lot of them talked about how their friends and that are in debt, and they didn't have a lot of advice on exactly what college costs are all about, and maybe managing their own personal affairs even. Do you have any comments on that, or do you think you could do a better job, or is that your number two priority in statute, or am I way off base there?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that we've been a cabinet agency for 3 years, and before that it was an independent agency with a bunch of programs kind of bundled together under a roof, and before that it was a coordinating board. So we've done well in some areas. I think we have room to grow. I don't see us as an oversight agency. I've never said that. That's not in our statute. But when higher education initiatives or programs or reports are handed out, we are the one place in state government that does look across all of higher education. And it is, I believe, an appropriate place for those initiatives and programs to come. There isn't anywhere else, unless you're being in institution or system specific, for those programs to go. We've been very careful about that, because the agency in the past got into trouble in the 90s for overreaching and for stepping too heavily into the oversight role, and that's not something that I'm interested in. to your point on our core function, you know, I think we do a good job on the state grant program. I think since Mr. Minicanis has been on board, we've done a much better job on our projections, making sure that the legislature is informed. We've been regularly meeting with staff and others and with system folks to make sure that we're on target. In terms of the debt issues, I don't disagree with you at all. I'm very concerned about the debt issues that students are facing. And we've had several reports that we've looked at. Ms. Grimes actually authored one of the reports on debt at our agency recently. So if you're concerned about our focus, you know, we're always open to better ideas about how to do our job better. But I would not agree that we haven't done a good job. I think we can do a better job.
And I hope I didn't imply that you haven't, although, you know, I guess with the stories coming in here and the amount of debt we're talking about, and you're, by the way, your grant programs and that have increased over the years, I mean the dollar amount, but yet you serve the same amount of students and the debt is just skyrocketing for these students. And you know, maybe there's something else that can be done. I don't know. You know, you hear anecdotal evidence about kids nowadays, you know, wanting to have cars and iPods and, you know, high-definition TVs, which I just got one, by the way. They are fun. It took me till I was 56 to get them. So, you know, maybe that's anecdotal evidence. But I think a lot of it is just because of the debt we're throwing at them because of what we've done in cutting back on funding. So, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't know if these core functions that you put down here on page 3 are prioritized or not, but obviously a little bit more has to be done. And before I call and represent property, let me just ask one question. You know, textbooks were a big issue, and I think you have to do something on it. And I know that you had a textbook study, but, you know, you think it's wise to put the publishers of the textbooks on the study and then ask them to come forward with some ideas. You want to comment on that, or am I, again, off in dreamland here?
Well, Mr. Chair, our report just came out, and it's available on the web right now. We decided to take this on. You know, it had been something that the legislature had been interested in. You know, there wasn't a policy bill last year, so we decided to take it on anyway. And I guess our feeling was that it was okay to include publishers in the group as part of the group as long as they didn't dominate. And we were concerned about that. I mean, they had there were a number of publishers who were representatives who were able to come in from around the country. We were concerned about the numbers, and we tried to really watch for that. But it is a prominent an issue of concern. I think in our report, we haven't listed recommendations, but we've laid out strategies in the report that I think you could look at and decide whether there's some action that you'd like to take. I don't think we felt comfortable making recommendations without bringing the report before you so that we could, you know, work with you on possible directions.
Well, maybe I can see you after, or, you know, schedule some.
That would be great. We'd be very open to that. The other, I just had to make a quick follow up on your on the debt piece. I think that there's much more education that we could be doing about debt and the cost of college, and that's a place where right now at our agency we're taking a look at that. We've also been working with the U and Minsky and the private colleges to try to work on a college encouragement campaign. Part of that college encouragement campaign, and it involves involves better educating students and providing them with good information about the cost of college.
Representative Pocky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the intervention for college attendance program, and you said that you're now adding retention to that, and back in slide 28, it talks about how you provided nearly $500,000 to 14 programs in 2006. Could you tell me what those programs are and what you might see as other kinds of programs with that?
Is that something you do? Mr. Chair and Representative Poppy, I don't have the list in front of me right here, but we have it available to us unless one of my colleagues here has the list. We have that back in our office. But it was there were some TRIO programs in the list.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, there's some community organizations. I believe one was called Women Empowering Women. Many of the, several of them were at existing colleges. It's a kind of a range of organizations, some secondary institutions and some community organizations
sprinkled throughout the state.
And then just to follow up on adding retention into that, I guess I'm just probably curious about what you would see as the kinds of activities you would be engaged in order to support retention.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, I think that, as I mentioned, what happens is the same students that had challenges getting to college, those don't stop once they get there. Mm-hmm. There are strategies that are helpful to students to keep them focused on their academics and in college. And there are some good programs that are out there right now. We don't know what all of those are, but this one of the things would be, I think, to highlight exemplary programs and then share best practices with others.
Thank you. One final question, I think, is... because I guess I'm a little confused about if you're actively engaged in some retention kinds of activities or if the colleges themselves would be offered the dollars, and would that be by grant request, or is that something that's going to be more equitably distributed, or how you would see that? Just, I guess I'm just curious about that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Poppe, it would be the same way that it's operated now. It's a competitive program. There are 16 recipients. If there was more money in the program, we could offer more grants to organizations. But I could see us looking at a mix of encouragement programs and then retention programs. So an applicant might be focused on retaining students in college. Another applicant might be focused on trying to get students to college. And so it is a competitive program. It's public and private. It's all across the state. So we're very open. As long as the programs are quality and they can show a good, you know, that they'll build a good track record, we're happy to take a look.
Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on your point and suggest that the committee, your point being that we heard from the students that they had a lot of debt. And then one of the questions I asked was if the state aid was meeting the need, and they said that they were able to meet every request that came in. And I think that what this committee should do is look at how this state grant framework is put together. I mean, the slides that they had from slide 12 to 15 show we're assigning a student responsibility at just under $8,000. And I think what the students were saying to us is that that's kind of backbreaking. And I mean, if we're in a situation where our state aid granting office is telling us they're able to meet all the applications, but we have students telling us that they're swimming in debt, I think we should look at how we are currently administering the state grant and if there's some way that we can reach more students. The other thing that I'm concerned about, in addition to the student responsibility being assigned so high, is that the families that have two incomes, or the family adjusted gross income, at like $75,000, $65,000 per year, that the students aren't at all eligible for the Minnesota State Grant anymore. And I think when you look at what that means in today's families, that's not a whole lot of money for more than one income earner in the family. So I guess what I would like to do is work with Ms. Grimes or also with our committee administrator on what changes do we need to make to this student aid program so that it's better meeting the needs of our students that we're talking about their debt, and so that we don't hear our students saying we need more money and our Office of Higher Education saying we gave out all the money and everybody's needs are met.
Do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, you know, we'd be happy to talk with you more about this. I think we should probably set up an individual appointment with you, but we had a hearing last fall, and we're always open to ideas. I guess my point was that given the structure of the program right now and the parameters that are in the program, without any changes, we're able to meet the demand that we face. That's not to say that there isn't more need. Demand and need are really very different things, as you pointed out. So we'd be happy to talk with you, you know, more about that.
And one of the things I'm interested in learning is what's our responsibility in terms of structuring the program, and what's rule-based, and what's your responsibility. So,
well, Sigurd, along those lines, you mentioned that you didn't spend or you had money in one of your programs at the end, the self-loan or whatever it was. But regarding the grant program itself, do you spend all... You mentioned something yesterday about not spending all the money and before you go into the general fund.
Yes, Mr. Chair. What had happened in the past is that if there was a surplus, a difference between appropriation and spending, that money in the past had gone back to the general fund. Now, there 2 years ago, there was a change in statute that the legislature agreed to that said that the, any extra money in the program goes to living and miscellaneous expenses, LME, the acronym. So that's what we did last year. We metered it out twice. We would have preferred to do it just once, and the financial aid director, I think, would have agreed. But we did two disbursements of the money, and the total was about $800 additional dollars to students.
Well, are you getting a little better at your projections, and that at the end of the year you won't have that surplus? And I guess my question would be, do you think maybe you could have some suggestions to us on how to make the grant program better so that these students aren't coming in here? And because we're obviously not meeting their needs. The costs are skyrocketing, whether it's textbooks or tuition, and something has to be done. And I don't know if we can find the money. I think maybe we're going to have to look at, maybe we've got to do something also with the formula itself. I don't know. I'm green at this, member, so forgive me, but I've been around here long enough to know that, you know, sometimes when we try to fix things, we make them worse, and I'm a little hesitant about doing that, but obviously you might be able to do a better job too, because you're having money left over, and I don't know if it's the formula or if it's just you've got to get fine-tuned on your projections or whatever.
I'll ask Mr. Miscanis to respond to the projection piece of this, because I think he's really the one who oversees this, and I think it has gotten better. At least we've heard from others that it's gotten better than it was in the past. But to your point, we've put some changes on the table in the current proposal for the state grant program that I think benefit lots of different types of students. Students at private institutions, students that are public, I should say higher cost institutions, students at lower cost institutions, students who fall above the Pell Grant line. So those students between like $25,000 and $60,000 in income, we tried to create a place for deeper grants for those students. There's always greater need, and that costs more money. But given what we had to work with, I think we put the best proposal that we could on the table. If the legislature is interested in providing more money for the state grant program, we'd be very happy to talk about how that could be spent, and we'd provide some options for you.
Mr. Cannon.
Mr. Chair, members, this is for you that have served on finance committee support. There's a difference between what's considered a forecasted program and one that's not. This is not, although it has all the characteristics of forecasted programs. You know, they're individual based. This is a low income program. And for that reason, a lot of times the areas in the past have been, I think, enlarged, if you will, because we don't have time in between appropriation process to make adjustments. Having said that, I think that we have dramatically improved the projections process. We're now linking things with the Department of Finance and some of the estimates they make for revenue purposes. We simply missed some important variables in the past, and now they're part of the process. So I don't think we're going to end up with. There's always going to be an error. There's no question about that. But we're never going to end up with the errors that we've had in the past, because I think we've just improved our processes.
Representative McFarland.
Chair Rukavina, you did ask my question already about the textbooks, but I came up with another one in the meantime. It's mainly an observation. I am seeing in every committee I go to that everybody's asking for technology money. Because we need better access statewide. It could be in business with sales tax filing, everything. Could somebody assure me that somebody is coordinating all these technology needs so that we are using our money efficiently?
No, we can't assure you of that. Representative Gunter. Representative McFarland, I think I said it early on in this committee that when Ms. King was here from Minsky, you know, we were going to have this computer statewide system project that was going to save paper and save money and put $27 million, I think, was the request at the time. Representative Murphy, you're the only one around here that was here then. And there you go. Speaking of technology, thank you, Ms. Guy. Turned everything off on us. Good job. How appropriate that is. But I guess Representative Sertich would say that was serendipitous, you know. But
I don't know. There were times when the State Government Finance Committee was supposed to oversee that, and actually I was chair, and then Representative Pawlowski, who was chair of higher ed at the time, didn't want me to oversee MNSCU and the U, and, you know, there's turf battles that go on. I think you've really hit on something, because the cost of technology, whether it's computers or cell phones or whatever, for state government, local units of government, school districts, is, you know, it's out of this world. And it's and we all hear how we got to have it to stay competitive, but it costs money.
Yep.
And sometimes the programs that the people you're supposed to be helping aren't, we're cutting the programs and the people that serve them and in place, trying to replace it with technology, and it's just, you know, it's a problem. You solve it, you tell me how to solve it. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got came with a new plan, new question too. As far as her statement about technology, I remember it's very apparent in the other part of this committee, when the Department of Commerce can write a website, a rather sophisticated website, for something like $60,000, and DTED at the same time had the same website development done for $600,000+. And yet, I don't see a whole lot of difference between the complications of one or the other. It all depends who does it, I guess. And there is no oversight over that. And the other statement I wanted to make is, as far as the cost of student loans, I think if we go down to the basic cost of higher education, period, is greatly determined by us. And I apologize, this is my first time I was in higher ed committee. But certainly at one time we covered 67% of the cost of a student's education. Today, for the first time, it's below 50%. So I think if we're going to look at reasons why the debt is growing so much, I think we have to look within a little bit. And I know, without a doubt, there's a lot of extenuating circumstances and lack of money that we have to deal with. And as you mentioned, with the budget this year, is probably grossly overstated, and things probably will come in the February forecast that will even change it more. But when you look at the real reason college education, the difference between 67% and 49% is 25%. 25% more they're paying than they were when it was 67%. So I think we have to look inward a little bit, and I don't know what we're going to do about it. That's why you're the chairman now.
Mr. Representative Gunther, let me just, and I'm going to call on Representative Haas as the final call. And Ms. Hegart, if you have to go somewhere, did you have to go somewhere, you just go ahead. Because we're pontificating here now, but let me just say this. You know, I find it ironic that we've got a loan, a student loan system where we have to go to the bond house, and it's revenue bonds, and I understand we've issued some tax-free revenue bonds, so what we've got now are revenue bonds that are 7% interest, I don't know, a little over, and being bought by people that have the wherewithal to buy them that are going to pay zero taxes because they're tax-free bonds, and the students paying 7%, I think we got a little adjusting to do in our society. So it's going to take some intestinal fortitude, and maybe we need some help from your side of the aisle too, because, you know, we're going to have to raise some revenue somewhere, I think. This is my feeling, and where we raise it is a different question, but think about that when you're sleeping today. By the way, I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about a grudge I had with former Representative Haas. So, anyway, just a note. But think about that when you're sleeping at what I just said. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Chair.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to point out that our computer systems are getting a little outdated, too. I was having trouble the other day deleting on my system, and I called the staff tech, and he come in, and he shook it like that, and I said, what's that about? And he said, check the trade name. It's an Etch-a-Sketch. So. But with that, members, we'll see you next Tuesday meeting. It's